This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the story behind the story, the news behind the news, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that's going to determine just what the future will bring. Now, I want to introduce to you Dr. Lawrence Dunnigan. And Dr. Dunnigan is a pediatrician. He practices in the eastern part of the United States. And he's been practicing in it for 30 years. But some 28 years ago, he heard a fascinating lecture given by Dr. Day, who had been a professor at the medical school he had attended. And this talk was given to a group of young doctors with the proviso that nobody would take notes and nobody would record what was said. Dr. Day then went on to become a director of the Planned Parenthood Federation. So right now, let's introduce Dr. Dunnigan. Dr. Dunnigan, it's so good for you to be with us, or to have you with us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
All right, fine. Well, why don't you just give our listeners the background of this incredible, incredible story you heard 28 years ago, which is so prophetic as far as what's unfolding today. And let me just, for the listener, comment that one of the things that was said 28 years ago was we would have sex without reproduction and reproduction without sex. Yes. And as we begin thinking about the artificial insemination and now the new cloning process, you realize that what was said 28 years ago to a young pediatrician is all coming to pass today, a part of a long-range plan of a group of men who do have an agenda. So why don't you pick up the story from there?
Well, when we sat down to listen to the lecture, we were all expecting something clinical. Dr. Day, his areas of primary research concern had always been newborn, premature birth, and the problems with carnicterus coming from neonatal jaundice, and temperature control in premature babies. So we were all expecting something scientific, and as the presentation unfolded, it was quite a surprise because there was nothing scientific. It was all what we might call sociologic. And as you alluded a while ago, Dr. Day had indicated that he wanted to see nobody taking notes or using a tape recorder because the things he was going to talk about, actually he said in the process, if you ever quote me on these things, I will deny them. He seemed to be indicating that there could be some sort of physical danger to him for speaking out about such things. That was more a suggested, I think, rather than an explicit statement. But, you know, when you hear that sort of thing very early in what you're anticipating to be a scientific presentation, that really caught my attention. You know, what are you going to be telling us that could put you in some danger one way or another? So, anyway, as the presentation unfolded, he began by stating that anybody with an eighth grade education could do the arithmetic and determine that the Earth would soon be overpopulated if there were no limits put on human reproduction. And part and parcel of the overpopulation then would be outgrowing our natural resources and overpollution of the planet. These people always refer to the world or the Earth as the planet. So in the beginning, it seemed as though presentation was almost an apology for things that we would, in the audience, find unpalatable, but there were several times in the presentation where he would say, this is the only way. There's no other way. This is sort of implying that he knew these things would maybe not sound acceptable to many, if not all, in the audience. So the thing that he really, this whole thing hung on was population control. And up until that time, I had heard, most of us had heard that term, population control. To me, it primarily meant limiting births. By the end of the presentation, I realized that population control has a much, much broader meaning than just limiting the number of births and even who or who may not be allowed to give birth. Because the presentation covered just every human endeavor, education, employment, industry, entertainment, sports, toys for children, clothing, a whole bunch of things that maybe we can get into as we go on here as time allows. But mentioning, as you did, sex without reproduction and reproduction without sex, that was an important part of this. Also, money and banking, which was toward the end of his presentation. The cashless society, move from cash to credit cards to a single credit card to a single identifying card, and then ultimately at the end, because cards can be lost or stolen, some sort of implant under the skin. In those days, silicone implants were under the very first stages of development. Silicone is inert, so the body tends to tolerate it fairly well. And this implant then would serve as identification and be an element in carrying on commerce, which, as I say, would replace cash, replace checks from a checking account, replace plastic credit cards, which back at that time were starting to really accelerate in use, so that all of these items that serve your financial banking needs also would serve for identification, and this could be implanted. I'm laughing because at the time he said, some of you hearing this will right away think there's a religious connotation here. And at that time, I had no idea what he's referring to. I was not much of a Bible scholar. And then it was only later that I read the book of the Apocalypse about the mark of the beast on the hand of the forehead. And I made the connection, and I realized why he said what he said.
Did he tell you what the relationship was to banking and international finance, or was this just a casual remark about the fact that we would progress to a situation or a society where everybody would be marked and identified?
He went... the presentation was that... the changes that he was projecting from then, 1969, the target date to have them all in place was the turn of the century.
The year 2000, right.
Give or take a few years according to how well it would progress, but that was where they were shooting. And this was worldwide, not just the United States or not just the United States, Europe, and you know, so-called Western civilization. But this was to be global, the entire world.
Now, did he tell you who was going to be doing it, or was it just it's going to happen and there's some group behind this?
It's going to happen. He never used a proper noun. He used only one proper noun in the entire presentation. That it was the Rockefeller Institute.
Now, what was the tie of the Rockefeller Institute into this? Now, did he say?
That had to do with research and treatment of cancer.
And there was something about they had treatments for cancer, but they didn't want to release them because we had to have people dying off. What was that?
Yes, that's just about what it was, that many or most cancers now could be cured. Now, this is back in 1969. Many or most cancers now are curable, but the information has been held in Rockefeller Institute files. Because imagine what would happen if people stopped dying of cancer.
And, of course, that's exactly what Thomas Malthus wrote about back in 1800. You know, we had to have people dying so we could have new people born.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. Pardon me for interrupting you, but I just wanted to bring that fact out. So this is 28 years ago. You're hearing the predictions of what the future holds for the world. So why don't you pick it up from there?
Well, I'm just trying to recall where he started. There was this general overview about controlling birth, who may or may not be allowed to have birth, implying that certain people would be not allowed to have children. Most people would be allowed two. Exceptional people might be allowed three, but never more than that. The replacement statistic that is widely quoted is 2.1 births per couple. The 0.1 meaning, two would replace the two parents, and then the 0.1 is because of some untimely deaths, so disease or accident or whatever, so replacement levels felt to be just a little above 2. In that context, too, he mentioned that something we feel that we can accelerate and control evolution. And this was in the context of controlling who might be allowed to reproduce. In other words, if your genes were acceptable, you would be allowed to bear children. But if they were not, you might be forbidden to bear children. That's when the business about sex without babies and babies without sex got some development in that certain people who had desirable genetic characteristics that should be perpetuated for the good of the world would be encouraged to reproduce, but they need not reproduce in the natural way through sexual intercourse, but this could be all done in the laboratory. And along those lines, the question which he anticipated, by the way, I should say there was no opportunity for any of us in the audience to ask any questions, but because the sexual instincts are so strong, he said you might think that at first we would try to de-emphasize sex, but that's nearly impossible to do because the feelings are so strong. So the plan is to go the other way, to encourage sexual activity, promote sexual desire, but do it in such a way that it's directed away from reproduction. And part and parcel of that then was the promotion of contraceptive devices. They would be promoted in such a way that it would be just instinctive and natural that when you were thinking about sex, you would automatically connect it to contraception. That sex without contraception would be sort of a deliberate mental process, but most sexual activity would be linked to contraception. Now, how do you do that? Well, sex education in the schools.
And was he talking about sex education and its importance back there in 1969?
Yeah, he developed that to some extent, that this would be taught in the schools. Kids would be taught to see the birth control pill was 69. Birth control pill came in about...
It was around in the early 60s, wasn't it? Mid-60s?
Yeah, early to middle 60s.
Right.
And so this was all fairly new stuff. And, of course, he talked about things that had been around a while, too, condoms and diaphragms. But that this would be taught in the schools. The use of these. I remember that particularly because as he was saying this, I was recalling some of my teachers from high school and say, oh, I can remember Miss So-and-so, but, you know, she would never feel that she could talk about these things. Of course, I was thinking of one of my algebra teachers. he was talking about something entirely different. But, you know, that was a connection I made in my mind that in my high school this never would have gotten off the ground.
Now, you were frantically taking notes all during this lecture on napkins that you had, so that nobody would really realize you were taking notes because you'd been asked not to, but you sensed that this was important, so you were recording this for posterity at the time.
Yes. Many of the things that he said I had heard before from other sources, primarily one source, which I considered to be unreliable. And I'd heard it at length with some repetition to the point where actually it became annoying to me. And I dismissed it because I considered the source not reliable. And here, then it was a few years later. See, the first I'd heard it was from this viewpoint. I stand out here seeing over there that there's a conspiracy going on. It's very broad-based, it's very pervasive, it's very subtle, nobody knows it. And only a few of us who are able to see this know what's going on. Well, I dismissed that. Well, then here in 1969, I heard from the other end, I'm part of it. I know what's going on. I've been told what's going on. I've been privy to certain privileged information, and here it is. So, you know, hearing all this stuff from a different perspective, I'm not an outsider looking in. I'm an insider speaking out the window to you. Believe me, that had quite an impact. So that most of the things he said I had heard before, and then as the talk unfolded and quite frankly was offensive in many ways to me, it wasn't things that I was hearing for the first time, but rather confirming some things that I had heard before, like the relocation of industries, breaking down our armed forces, shipping our jobs overseas so that unemployment would go up. Those were some that I'd heard before and would not believe.
But, of course, one of the things he talked about was how we were going to encourage people to buy foreign products because we were intentionally going to produce shabby cars in America so that people would buy Japanese. And, of course, in 1969, most people would have thought that was crazy talk. But what did he say along that line with the idea that this would then justify the shifting of American industries to foreign countries?
Yeah, this was to establish the global economy. The idea being we would have one global worldwide commercial system. It wasn't his term originally, but he alluded to what they call the Declaration of Interdependence. I think it was Buckminster Fuller who wrote that. It's sort of a parody or takeoff on Jefferson's Declaration of Independence for our country. And it's been a while since I've read that, but the opening sentences of the Declaration of Interdependence are an echo of our Declaration of Independence. And the idea is that every part of the world should be involved in a single economy, with different parts of the world having emphasis on different aspects of a global economy. And the United States was to be the information center. Our smokestack industries were to be sent to other countries.
Then did he explain how that would come about?
Just that the people who make the decisions, the captains of industry and politicians would get together and decide, we'll close a steel mill here and reopen it there.
Now, what was this about building in obsolescence to American cars so that they'd break down and people would become disillusioned with our vehicles and buy Japanese?
Yes, the idea was to promote specifically the Japanese auto industry. this was a principle that was applied other ways, but they wanted to build up the hard industries in Japan and not eliminate ours, but de-emphasize them. So that the way to do this was if you bought an American-built car and the door handle kept coming off or the window crank would fall off, or some piece under the hood that should have been made of metal was made of plastic and it would crack, and you would become irritated by that, and then your neighbor who had a Japanese car would say, well, I've driven this for so many years and so many thousands of miles, and all I do is change the oil and the tires.
Well, and did Dr. Day actually talk about this?
Well, yeah, he said this was in the plans.
This was the long-range plan as of 28 years ago,
yes.
To begin orienting Americans towards buying foreign products by intentionally creating inferior products in America. I know my wife was saying the other day that she doesn't hate to buy anything, clothing made in America, because it just falls apart, you know. The threads come out, the buttons pop off, and, you know, of course, she attributed this just to, you know, accidental shoddy workmanship, but you're suggesting that maybe there is a plan, at least as far as certain of our products, to discourage Americans from buying them to actually buy them overseas, thus transferring America's wealth, industry, and production to other nations as we then lose jobs here in America?
Right, right. I remember this particularly because, as a matter of fact, I probably was laughing to myself, as I do now when I recall it.
I think they could never get away with this.
Well, I was a child during World War II, and I remember that we always laughed at things that were stamped made in Japan.
Right, I remember that too.
And we were very proud that American-made goods were more reliable and more enduring. And so this was a complete about-face. That which was made in Japan now was going to be the superior product and ours the inferior product. And part of the idea behind this was a psychological preparation that there's sort of a, should we say, patriotism. You know, things that are made in my hometown are the best. Things that are made in my state are the best.
Things that are made in America are the best because we're the best country in the world. And they were trying to destroy that belief?
Yes, yes. So that you would say, well, I might be a patriotic American, but, gee, I can't afford to be buying second-rate stuff when I can save money buying a foreign import. So patriotism would take a back seat to economy. You know, to my personal economy. And this then would break down the kind of loyalty to your locale or to your nation and foster a more cosmopolitan citizen of the world attitude.
Destroy the love of country.
Uh-huh.
Okay, fine. I think that's such a fascinating insight into the mentality of these people who seem to have such tremendous power over education, over industry, or even over our ways of reproduction today. Well, what other sorts of things did they talk about? I remember one thing that you mentioned was how they were going to encourage sexuality, and they were going to try to get people's minds oriented onto sexuality. Did they talk at all about homosexuality and how that would be used?
Yeah, that would be promoted, not just merely tolerated or permitted, but actually to be promoted. The idea being that no child ever results from a homosexual union. The business of morality, especially a religious-based morality, really would have no part in this future. Which is the present now.
It's almost, you laugh because it's so ridiculous what has transpired, and you either laugh or you cry.
Well, you know, between then and now, it's been quite an experience to watch this unfold right according to the script.
Right. The unfolding nightmare is the moral foundations of our once great Christian society are progressively undermined.
Consider this. If we're going to have babies without sex and sex without babies, then for large part, we interchange the sexes. There's no real difference between men and women.
Did he stress that, how we were going to feminize men and masculinize women?
He more stressed masculinizing the women than he did feminizing the men. And this would start in youth. For example, one of the things he mentioned was that toys that were available for children would be changed. Girls would get footballs and soccer balls, and baby dolls and tea sets, little domestic kits like a dustpan and broom. Some of that would disappear entirely, and other things like that would be very, very greatly de-emphasized.
In other words, trying to undermine the maternal or these rather normal instincts that women have for being housekeepers to get them more out into the labor market.
Yes, exactly.
And certainly if they're out in the labor market, they're not going to be having children.
That's right. If mom's at home and she's enjoying her first and second baby, she's likely to say, well, it's time for third and fourth.
Right.
And I can take care of these kids because my hubby's making a reasonable living, and we can support them.
And, of course, now you can't. You have to have the woman working because of the tax system and because of the actual, not in dollar amount, but in purchasing amount, decrease in the wages of the average American working male.
Yes. Yeah, the term they use is discretionary spending. And your discretionary spending, of course, you lose all discretion because the tax collector takes it. And so you're just trying to survive. And then if mom has one or two children that she worries about while she's at work, that's enough worry for her. So she's not going to say, well, I'm going to keep my full-time career and have more children. You know, that's just gets too much to be concerned about. Worrying about daycare, getting somebody to take care of the children.
And so what we're really talking about is an organized plan of social engineering laid out many, many decades ago that is coming to fruition really in the intervening decades.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. One other thing I wanted to develop a little bit, and then we could go on, and that's about the promoting of sexual activity.
Okay.
In 1969, abortion was a crime in every one of the states. And at that time, he said, well, it won't be long until abortion not only is no longer a crime, but will be seen as a right and be tax-supported. Which at that time sounded incredible. By promoting sexual activity among youngsters and linking it strongly to contraception, the planners realized that more pregnancies would occur. The idea then was, that's okay. If there are more pregnancies that occur, we'll have an abortion backout. And people who would otherwise oppose abortion will change their mind when they say, well, this is my daughter who's pregnant at a young and tender age. And abortion restrictions might be okay for everybody else.
For the continuation of this program, please turn the tape over now.